Well, one impressive feature of Churches of Christ, and I'm talking about the congregations themselves, those that follow the New Testament pattern, that is the simplicity of their government. They have elders, they have preachers, they have deacons, they have teachers, and that's it. I mean, as far as responsibilities, there's other responsibilities that are all involved in that, but really we don't have a very sophisticated set of features there with regard to our government or our organization. And you compare that then with major denominations, not mentioning any, that's not the point, but you know what they are, or even major corporations like what we have around here, Boeing or Microsoft or Starbucks. They all have their hierarchy of functions and positions and vice presidents and managers and researchers and clerks and office staff and all those sort of things. And we just don't have all that. The church's otherworldly task is, however, more important than all the companies combined that I could mention this morning. Its work and its people are involved in something that lasts forever. We are involved in the afterlife and the matters of the afterlife. We're not just concerned with what happens here and now. And we deal directly with someone infinitely greater and more powerful and far more wealthier than Bill Gates or Howard Schultz. We are dealing with the Creator himself. That's a sobering responsibility, but that tells you the nature of our work. And so while a Church of Christ may appear to be insignificant to, say, Boeing or Microsoft or Starbucks, nonetheless, its mission is far more important and its members are far more successful than those people who are employed in those areas there, okay? And that's a powerful thing to admit up front. And yet, despite all that, we have a very simple and straightforward structure. We have no hierarchy to speak of. We have no layers and bureaucracy. And even though sometimes we form committees, they're just loosely formed committees. They don't become a permanent part of our structure, and they don't extend beyond the boundaries of the need for the moment there. Okay? So the responsibilities that we have are dictated through the New Testament pattern. Everyone is to cooperate in that. Every member is involved in some way or another. Elders are appointed to oversee the individual congregations, but we have one Lord who oversees them and oversees everything and everyone else. And that's how it is. It's very straightforward. There's no secrets. There's no secret agenda of any kind, no ulterior motive. We've been talking a lot about elders, of course, in our series here, and I want to just say, and I don't mean this as any slight whatsoever, but elders are not super intellectual men, and they're not necessarily well-educated men. They may not even have a college degree or even a high school diploma, for that matter. They don't go to seminary, necessarily, anyway. They don't have awards or certificates that they put on their wall that says, I have graduated from the School of Elders. And they don't have a DD after their name, typically, a Doctor of Divinity. So there's nothing necessary in that regard. And furthermore, if I can say so, without slighting our own elders in any way, they are fallible men. They are imperfect. They are capable of bad judgments. They are capable of unpopular decisions. In other words, what I'm saying to you is that they are very human in a spiritual organization. Not unlike preachers and teachers and deacons and so on, okay? We're all very human people, and we are susceptible to the same things that I just mentioned. Yet, ideally speaking here, elders are not ordinary men. I don't think there's anything ordinary, first of all, about being a Christian. And then secondly, they are our hand-picked leaders. And thirdly, the reason why we handpick them is because they are to represent the cream of the crop, and that they have taken years and even decades of preparation to prepare themselves to serve in the most important job in the world from God's perspective. And so it begs the question then, what criteria should we use to select such men? Well, notice that there's no resumes being handed out, there are no management training seminars, no formal interviews, and no IQ tests. And Christians often reduce this whole procedure down to a list of job qualifications, and yet God's criteria is really focusing on character issues and leadership skills. And that's what I want to talk to you about this morning and this evening. This morning we're going to address mostly character issues. Tonight we'll talk more so about leadership skills. Neither lesson is exclusive to one or the other, however. But that's where God is coming from in His Word. And I'm saying this because congregations in selecting elders or even appraising their own current elders traditionally tend to be more critical than realistic when they choose their elders. They have a higher standard for those men than they do even for themselves. And that is just not right. Congregations are terrified often of, you know, appointing an unqualified man. That's how it's usually put. Well, we don't want to appoint an unqualified elder. And so they meticulously scrutinize and dissect the list of qualifications. But do you notice that there's no perfect matches? In other words, here's the list, if you will, and then here's the men we have to choose from, whoever they are. And you notice that there's no perfect matches. And so that makes us then, I hope, that forces us to be realistic. Not who's the perfect man, but rather who is able to get the job done the way that God wants it done. And that's really what we're looking for, aren't we? We need a right man for the job. Someone who can get the job done, but someone who can get the job done rightly. The way that God wants it done, not just the way that we want it done. Or the way that they want it done, for that matter. So two things are very clear to me anyway. First of all, it takes a spiritually disciplined man who is committed to the Lord to hold the office of an overseer. That's one thing I see. And the second thing I see right up front, I hope you do too, is it takes a spiritual-minded, submissive, Christ-loving congregation to appoint such a man without losing sight of its own mission in the process. So that lays the responsibility on both parties. We have the men themselves who need to own up to the responsibility of leadership, but we also have the congregation itself that needs to appoint those men and do so without partiality and without favoritism and without ignoring their own moral responsibilities to God, okay? Well, I want to address the first thing first, and that is that an elder must be a man. And I know already this chafes against a lot of the modern perspective. In fact, we've been taking the task in the past over different visitors who've come here and say, how come you don't have women elders or women preachers or, you know, women public teachers and that sort of thing? Well, if you look in your New Testament, first of all, we have explicit instruction about elders, about them being men and husbands of one wife and so on. And then in the other cases, we have precedent and practical reasons why we can answer those other things. I'm not going to get into all the other. I want to focus on elders. But an elder is to be a man. He is not to be a woman. And we're not appointing the wife of an elder alongside an elder. Although the wife does have a bearing upon who her man is, we're not appointing her to a position there. Everyone needs to know their place. And I know that sounds kind of almost chauvinistic to say it that way, but I need to know my place too. I need to know where my place is as a preacher. I need to know what my relationship is to the congregation and to the elders and what my responsibilities are there. Deacons need to know their place. Men need to know their place. Women need to know their place. Preachers' wives need to know their place. Elders' wives need to know their place. Everyone needs to know their place. And all we're talking about here is propriety more than anything else. We're just simply talking about not everyone can be in charge all at once. But at the same time, someone has to be in charge. And so we need to understand and appreciate, and we've been talking a lot about this in this series. You know, we need leadership, but we also need followership. We need oversight, but we also need submission to that oversight, and so on, right? So we need to have all these things in place. An elder's wife is not on par with her husband. She does not share the same responsibility or the same oversight. She's not held to the same standard. And an elder's wife is not qualified to be an elder. She is not appointed to be an elder. And she's not allowed to act as an elder by default or by assumption there. And I'm saying this because this is so abused in congregations generally where we have a dominant personality as an elder's wife. At the same time, we should ask ourselves regarding a candidate for an elder. If an elder candidate will not stand up to his own wife or to his children when it is unpopular to do so but necessary, then how in the world is he going to stand up for the congregation when it is unpopular but necessary to do so? You see what I'm getting at? Really what God is getting at. So when we appoint an elder, we are not appointing his family, we're not appointing his marriage, we are appointing the man himself. Does his marriage and family bear upon who he is, however? Oh, absolutely. And we'll get much more into that tonight. Okay, so really what we're asking is, well, what kind of man are we to appoint? And everyone would say, well, we need to appoint someone who's qualified. Well, what exactly does that mean? Because up front, honestly, it sounds a bit rigid or clinical or mechanical, like they have to be certified and they have a certain degree, you know, in being qualified, because, you know, that we see that in so many other professions. Don't you agree? If you're going to go to your dentist, for example, hopefully your dentist is qualified, which means that he's gone to dentistry school, and he's got a bunch of, you know, education certificates, and he's got a degree and proof of that. Well, when we talk about elders, we're not talking about the same thing necessarily, you know, with the degrees and all the protocol, but we are talking about someone who does have qualities and, in essence, qualifications for doing the job of being an elder. And someone says, well, we just go to the lists in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1. But if you compare those lists, you'll find out very quickly that they're not identical. And that begs the question, did Paul write two different lists to two different men to appoint two different kinds of elders? Or is the same list simply being spoken in two different ways? And when I mentioned this morning, we're in Luke chapter 12 this morning. Luke chapter 12, if you compare that to Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the so-called Sermon on the Mount, if you compare those two, you realize very quickly that Jesus is giving the same discourse, the same sermon, if you will. But you also notice that he words things differently, and he highlights something in one text that he doesn't highlight in the other, emphasizing something in one place that he doesn't emphasize in the other. But can you come to the same conclusion of what he's talking about? Do they both come to painting, if you will, the same kind of person that he wants of us? Yes. And can we say the same thing about Paul? Whatever he says to Timothy in 1 Timothy 3, isn't he saying, in essence, the same thing to Titus? In other words, if Timothy and Titus were both to appoint an elder in their own areas there, would they appoint the same type of man? Yes, they would. And that tells us a lot, I hope, about the criteria themselves. We want to see the criteria for what it is, and not just a bunch of job listings or job descriptions or postings there. We want to see that as really character issues and leadership skills. If you think about it, qualifications is our word. It's not a word found in the New Testament, specifically not to elders. And if we understand Paul's intent, that he is describing character issues and leadership skills, then that changes everything about how you see the qualifications, doesn't it? And we're not scouring the man's entire life who wants to be an elder. We're not looking back and say, you know what, when you were 16... you know, you did this thing. I mean, if you look back at my life when I was 16, I did a lot of dumb things. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Don't go looking. Okay, my whole point is I've grown since then, and I haven't been 16 for, 20 years or so. And so my point is that you can't just look at the whole man's life and criticize and critique every little point. You need to see where the man is now. You need to see what he's doing now based upon how he got there. Because he didn't get there overnight, did he? And if he is an older man, which he should be by necessity, the whole word elder implies an older man, well, then he's had a lot of time to get to where he's at. But you're not judging his every decision. You're not checking his resume of jobs and so on. But rather, by inspiration, Paul says, look at the man's heart, as demonstrated through his behavior. Not his behavior on one given incident, but his chronic or pattern behavior as exemplified over time and over a number of different scenarios. Look at his marriage. Look at his family. Look at his household. What kind of man is he? That's really what we want to examine. What kind of man is this candidate that we're looking at, whoever it might be, and ask ourselves, is he mature? Is he experienced? Is he hardworking? Does he honor Christ? Like in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15 there, where it says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart. Does he do that? Has he done that? Is he doing that now? Has he got a pattern of doing that? Can we see that? Do we see evidence of that? Those are the things that we're looking at. We're examining his character, not his hiring points. And neither list is meant to be exhaustive. And ironically, neither list says anything, for example, about the man's willingness or even ability to solve problems, although we would expect a man like that to be able to be a problem solver, wouldn't you think? And it doesn't say anything about his ability to deal with sensitive issues per se. It might be implied in some of the language there, but it doesn't really just come out and say he needs to be a man who can deal with sensitive issues. Although, as an elder, he's going to deal with a lot of private and sensitive issues. I can tell you that, not because I am an elder, but because sometimes elders and myself have to deal with the same issues. And they're private and sensitive, and we understand that. And that takes a certain kind of individual that has to deal with those things. It doesn't say whether he is forgiving and compassionate, although we would expect such a man to be such. It doesn't say anything about the color of his speech, that he's not to be a liar, not to be vulgar mouth, not to be a coarse jester, and so on. But mature Christian men don't engage in those things, so he doesn't have to say that. But it's not said anyway. And whether his marriage is successful, it does say that he needs to be married, but it doesn't say anything about the condition of his marriage. So if a man just waves a marriage certificate in your face and says, I meet the qualifications, I'm the husband of one wife, and you go, check, and then you're done. You are not examining the criteria in the way that it's supposed to be examined. You're treating it like a job listing or a hiring point rather than what it is, a character issue or a leadership skill. Do you understand what I'm saying here? And it doesn't say whether or not he's fully committed to the Lord, although we would expect that we would never appoint a man who is anything less than fully committed to the Lord. And that underlies all that actually is said. And just because something is not specifically mentioned doesn't mean that it's not important. God is expecting us to use our head here. He's expecting us to use common sense. And I'll give you some examples of what I'm talking about. For example, if a candidate's wife is rebellious, if she is offensive, if she is domineering, well, then you can't ignore that. Remember, we're not appointing the wife. I get that, and so should you. We just stated that earlier. But at the same time, if his wife is not cooperative with the work that needs to be done, then she's going to be like an albatross around his neck, if you know what I'm saying. She's going to be weighing him down like an anchor and detracting from his work rather than supporting it from behind, okay? And so we have to look at that. That says a lot about the man himself if he allows his wife to be that way. And if a candidate's finances are always in trouble, in excessive debt, he's always broke, he exhibits poor stewardship, well, then you don't want a man like that because it's clear that he's not a good manager, even though it's not specifically mentioned. If he has a history of not holding a job for long or bouncing around from job to job or even congregation to congregation, that shows instability. You don't want a man as an overseer who is unstable, I hope anyway. And if he's afraid of people or easily intimidated, well, then he's not a good candidate for an office which necessitates confrontation at times and the necessity to stand up for what you believe even when it's unpopular. If the candidate is lazy or unmotivated or just too passive, well, then he's unqualified. Because he has the wrong character, not because of some specific detail that Paul did or didn't write. He's just not the right man for the job. I hope I'm making sense here in what I'm saying. We don't have to go into all the lists of qualifications to determine by itself what kind of man he is. We can also use our common sense. I'm not saying we should use common sense instead of the list. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, the lists are there to paint a picture of a kind of man we are appointing, not every single detail of him. That's what I'm getting at. And I'll get into that more as we go along. Well, not every man should be an elder just because he's older. We don't make men elders just because they reach a certain age, do we? Okay? Like, oh, you hit 65, you're an elder, right? And we don't do that. And there's a reason for that. Some older men, quite frankly, are not a mature character. And if we do have men who are older and are mature, well, then there has to be some way to measure that maturity. There has to be some criteria or standard which we can measure that by. He ought to be able to demonstrate that as well. 1 Timothy 3, Titus chapter 1 gives us a picture of a mature man of God, not a flawless human being. And not every character in that list or lists there is necessary to be mature. In other words, what I'm saying is, for example, a man doesn't have to be married or have children in order to be a mature Christian man. But as far as the indication I understand it to be, he does need to be married and have children if he's going to be an elder. Okay? So he doesn't need to have those things, a marriage and a family, in order to be mature, but we're not talking about just a mature man. We're talking about a man who also meets the criteria, the characteristics that Paul has set forward here. And a man may be mature and have Christian character, but still not desire the office itself. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1, if you want to be with me there, and I'll read from that. In fact, we'll be citing from 1 Timothy 3, not necessarily reading it, but we'll certainly be citing from it here from this point forward. It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. That's what Paul says up front about this work here. Paul doesn't criticize men who don't desire that office or aspire to it. He's not criticizing them, but he does simply commend those who do have the desire. Nonetheless, desire is the first characteristic that ought to be considered. And there's some definitions here on the screen here. First of all, as far as aspiration, or, you know, if any man aspires to, well, that word isn't a passive word, and it's not used in a passive sense. As you can see on the screen here, it literally means a stretching forward, a reaching toward, a yearning for. I mean, there's obviously, you know, if I'm extending myself towards something, there's going to be some evidence of that. It's not just a man who's sitting back and going, yeah, I guess I could do that. Yeah, they need elders, and I guess, you know, I'm a mature Christian man, and I'm not doing anything else. I'm kind of in a good place in my life right now. It's not that at all. That's not aspiration, okay? That's just almost resignation to, yeah, there's an obligation, and I guess I can fill that obligation. And that's a very different thing. The word desire there actually comes from the same word in the Greek, which in other places in the New Testament is translated as craving or lust. But here it's obviously not used in a negative way, certainly not in a sexually negative way, but it's actually just referring to a strong desire. So this is not a man who says, yeah, I suppose I can do that, but he's earnestly and passionately seeking this office. At the same time, having said that I am going to tell you that we can, in fact, we must still say no to a man who does aspire and does desire that office if indeed he is not the right man for the job otherwise. What I'm telling you is that aspiration and desire are not enough by themselves. Even if a man really, really wants to be an elder, and sometimes we see that, where a man really, really wants to be an elder, but we look in the other criteria there and we say, you know, there's just some other things here that just aren't, you're not where you should be, or they're not going to support you in this, and therefore we have to decline. And we're not trying to rob him from his earnest passion and all that. We're just simply saying, we're just admitting, in essence, that this is the reality. You're just not the right man for the job. That doesn't mean there aren't other jobs you can do, and doesn't mean there isn't another kind of ministry you can fulfill. It's the same thing with preachers, by the way, if I can take the little detour here just for a moment. You know, just because someone desires to be a preacher doesn't mean that they're the right man for the job. Have you ever seen a man who is a preacher who really shouldn't have been? No personal comments about me right now. We can talk later if you want to. Okay, that wasn't a shout-out opportunity, Carol. But I'm sure that you have seen that before, where someone really, really wants to do the job and puts their heart into it and their sweat and their tears and everything else into it, but they just don't have what it takes to be that man, to be that, or I should say, maybe even to fulfill that responsibility. It's the same way here. So let's look at some of these characteristics, and we'll notice that some of them are very general, but nonetheless, the candidates that we're talking about here are going to manifest these characteristics in a polished, refined, and very practiced way. In other words, they aren't things that they just developed last week or last month, or they've been working on them, but they just really haven't got them there. They didn't just start last week or last month in this pursuit, but these traits or practices have become a regular part of their lifestyle for some time. I like to use the term well-seasoned, although some people take offense at that, I guess. But nonetheless, or a veteran, if you want, if that works for you, you know, as someone who's just been doing this for a while. And not a newcomer to that, okay? So most of the character traits that are given are the same as we would expect in any Christian. In fact, I'm going to go so far as to say what you see on the screen. There is no single character trait that is unique to elders that shouldn't be or couldn't be found in any mature and experienced Christian. If you think about it, there's nothing there that says only elders can have this one particular character or trait. There's just nothing there that I can see. Or we can't say, well, I expect them to be that way, but I don't have to be. Well, if you choose not to be married or have children, I understand that part. But as far as the rest of it, as far as character issues, you really should be pursuing those things yourself, as I should myself. And as we go through the character traits in 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, that we'll do in just a moment, I want you to consider yourself and how you match up, because you and I are not exempt from this. We should be striving for these very things. Okay, so let's look at that. First of all, he is to be a man who is above reproach, and that means blameless. It doesn't mean sinless, but because that is impossible. But it does mean also that he's not living in guilt before God, is really what blameless indicates here. He's not innocent of all sins in all time, but he is innocent as he stands now, as he stands in his life. He does not have a disreputable character. Genesis chapter 6, verse 9 talks about Noah, for example, being a blameless and a righteous man. Well, did Noah ever sin? Of course he did. He's a man. He sinned. But he doesn't stand in his guilt before God. And the idea here and throughout this whole section here is that these men are representing God to their families, to the congregation, and to the world. And we need men, therefore, who are respectable, and we need men who are reverent toward the word. And then we need to look at ourselves and ask ourselves, are we respectable? Are we reverent toward the word? How do you and I represent God to the world? Because the same thing applies to all of us. He needs to be a man who is temperate. Classical use of this English word, it usually means sober, as in abstaining from alcohol, okay? But in the classical Greek sense, it simply means sober-minded, more of a mental disposition rather than, you know, a drinking disposition, if you will, okay? He needs to be vigilant. He needs to be alert. He needs to be focused. He needs to be paying serious attention to his life and to his family and, yes, to the congregation, already paying attention to the congregation, not someone who's going to pay attention now that he's an elder. So I'm asking you, do you pay serious attention to your life and to your family and to this congregation? Or is that just something you expect the elders to do, but you're exempt somehow because you're not trying to be an elder? Really, remember, these lists here, if you want to call them that, are really dealing with character issues up front. So what is your character like? He is to be prudent, which means self-controlled, not driven by emotions, but disciplined to a godly lifestyle. Well, does that describe you? As it should, or at least you're on your way there. You're striving for that. That's the kind of person that you should be as well. And that's especially the kind of man that we need as an elder. He needs to be respectable, which means literally of good behavior, as it's used elsewhere in the two lists there. He needs to be proper. He needs to be dignified, as opposed to irrational and improper. Well, how about you? Are you proper and dignified? Not just when you're here, because you're all acting very proper and dignified right now, and I appreciate that. But what about when we leave and go back to our houses? Or what about Monday? Someone has said you can tell the character of a Christian by how he lives on Monday, not just what he says on Sunday. And there's a lot to that. Okay? What kind of person are you when you're not here? Are you respectable? Are you living honorably? And does it show in your action? Is he hospitable? Which literally means in the Greek, fond of guests or strangers. That's literally what the word means, a lover of strangers. And the strangers here don't have to be non-Christians. It's just people that he doesn't necessarily know or isn't familiar with. In other words, how I understand this in this context is he's interested in those outside of his own family, his own social group, and his own circle of friends. Outside of his own bubble. Is he willing to do that? To reach outside of that circle and extend a hand of friendship or even a hand of fellowship to those that he doesn't know right now? Because quite frankly, there's some men that are a pretty good character, but they really keep to themselves. And we tend to think, well, they're just introverts. Well, sometimes they're introvert in their temperament, but sometimes they just don't want to be bothered with someone else's problems. Or they don't want to be bothered learning about someone else because they already got their little circle of friends and family. And it bothers me, and I'm just going to say this out straight up, and you can take it for what it's worth, okay? That when we do have visitors here, we should expect our congregation to leave their place in the building and go to meet those visitors and not just meet them or shake their hands if they happen to cross our path. That's what I'm talking about here. Do you go out of your way to love those people, to show godly love to people that you don't know? What do you do? How do you express that? And don't expect that just of elder candidates or elders themselves or the preacher. You should expect that of yourself. And I realize the whole introvert thing. I'm not always a people person myself, believe it or not. I have a role that I function in here, and I need to function this way for this role. But quite frankly, I like to go to a quiet room and be by myself, okay? And so it's hard for me to get out and talk to some people. But honestly, this gospel is more important than Chad's sensitivities about that. It's more important than my what you might call not extrovert personality, okay? So, and it's more important than yours too. And I hope that you see that. Is he able to teach? That's a good quality that he needs to have. And we don't want to read this in a passive sense, like, well, can he teach if he has to, like if the preacher calls in sick or something like that? Can he put a lesson together? Now, that's not really what Paul means there. He's saying, is he teaching? And is he competent at doing so? That's what he's getting at. Is he a competent teacher by practice? Is he instructive? And that implies that he is well studied in the word. You don't need eloquence or oratory skill in order to be a good teacher. Rather, you simply need to be able to convey and communicate information in an effective manner. And not everyone, quite frankly, has that ability. As I said earlier, there are some men who aspire and desire to be elders, but they're not good teachers. And it's not because they're defective men. It's because they just don't have that ability or that gift, if you want to call it that, or that talent to be able to communicate what they know, all the knowledge they do have, in a productive and effective manner. Not everyone has that ability. So it's not a slight against their intelligence. It's not a slight against who they are as a person. It's just simply saying you just don't have that ability. Some people have it. Some people don't. Some people are very gifted in one area. Some people don't have a gift in another area. And that's just why we need a whole bunch of people to come together in the church and why the church is made up of many members and not just one or even one kind of member. We need many members. But one thing he has to do in that teaching, and Titus chapter 1, verse 9 brings this out, he needs to be able to defend sound doctrine. And in defending sound doctrine, he also needs to be able to know what unsound doctrine is and refute that as well. And he needs to be able to do that competently. Not just knowing the difference between the two, but able to put together a reasonable and intelligent response, either to prove the gospel is true or to prove that false teaching is false. He needs to be able to do that. Now we're moving on to 1 Timothy 3, where Paul says he needs to be not addicted to wine. Well, no drunkenness, obviously, and that implies self-control or temperance. And it can be applied to anything that a person can be addicted to, like drugs, smoking, swearing, pornography, gambling, overeating, right? Food, in other words. Okay? I mean, you can be addicted to all kinds of things. And really what we're talking about is we need a man who is not addicted to anything in the world. In other words, that is controlling him or clouding his judgment in what he's supposed to do. Doesn't that make sense? And we need a man who is not pugnacious, as it says in the New Testament term. And your other versions might say different word. I think the word, Phil, you read, what version are you reading from, Phil? Is it the English version? Because it has some different words. What is it? That's okay. That's not critical. I just didn't know if you knew up front. Because when you read that, you brought up in that translation some different usage of these words. And your Bible will maybe have different words. And that's good. It's actually good to compare different versions there. See how that word from the Greek can be translated into the English a little bit differently there. What is it? Okay, so there's a little different take on the translation from Greek to English there. But pugnacious means not a striker, as he says elsewhere. And what that means is he's not prone to or inclined to fight or brawl or punch. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen an elder who is inclined to brawl as a way of handling things. Actually, you might have. We've had problems with that in this congregation in years past, and in other congregations we've seen that as well. Okay, where people want to settle things by taking it outside, all right? I remember when I was a teenager in a business meeting, and a couple of guys, the biggest guys in the group, as it were, and they got in a heated discussion, and the discussion turned into, a challenge, and one of the guys says, hey, you want to take it out back, and we'll settle it that way. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, that's not how we handle things, I hope, all right? That's how the world handles things. That's not how Christians handle things. That's not the kind of man you want handling things for the church, right? So not someone who goes for that route as a means of settling things. And that gets back to also gentle and uncontentious, or patient, not a brawler. He's not violent, he's not rough, and he's not arguable, I think is a good word to say here. Not arguable, not argumentative, okay, or argumentative. In other words, he's not going to sit there when you come up to him and say, hey, brother so-and-so, I'm bothered by something that you said or something that you did. And he says, well, who are you to be bothered by me? And he gets in your face and red face and then starts getting very defensive about everything that you're saying. Instead of offering a rational explanation, say, hey, talk to me about this. What did you hear? How did you take that? And, oh, no, there's a misunderstanding. And so you could solve it that way. Or, hey, you're right. I shouldn't have handled it that way. I'm going to do better, and here's what I'll do next time, okay? Instead of doing that, he just kind of gets in that defensive mode. What we say of these men sometimes is that they're not approachable. Have you ever seen a person who's not approachable? I think you all know what I'm talking about, right? And where you can't come up to them and engage in an intelligent, rational discussion of disagreement. The only way in which they'll be nice to you is if you agree with them. But if you dare disagree with them or challenge them or question them in any way, they get hostile. And we can't have such a man like that. Honestly, he shouldn't even be, a Christian in good standing if that's the way he lives. But we especially can't have a man like that who is going to be appointed as an elder. And then free from the love of money, I think that goes without saying, but we'll say it anyway. Not covetous, not bound to a lifestyle that revolves around or is always focused on money and spending and materialism, not greedy, not enslaved. Once again, go through this list here and ask yourself, does that in any way describe me? Are you approachable? Are you argumentative? Are you gentle and uncontentious? Are you free from the love of money? How does that describe you? 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 6, it says he's not to be a new convert. Why? Well, because he's not experienced and not used to dealing with mature and spiritual matters, as we see in Galatians 1, verse 1 and 2. If anyone among you has sins, then you who are spiritual really, those of you who are mature, go and deal with that. Specifically, he can't be a new convert, so he won't allow this whole elder thing to go to his head. We don't need a man who's on a power trip, because pride does not pride is not effective, I should say, in this situation here, okay? We need a man who is experienced. It's interesting, Ecclesiastes 10, verse 16, it's not in your notes there, but it says, "Woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad," or a child there. And the principle there is, someone who is inexperienced and lacking wisdom has no business governing people. Just has no business doing that. We need someone who is experienced at governing people, especially his family first, and then the experience of governing others in smaller circles before we appoint him over our entire congregation. And I'll just read 1 Timothy 3:7. It says that he must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil there. And that, in other words, what is his relationship with non-Christians at work, in the neighborhood, in the community? Is he a hypocrite? Is really what we're getting at. Is he one way here, but then very much a different way when he's by himself or in his home environment? Is he religious and pious and cooperative to the congregation, but a very different person elsewhere? And then ask yourself, what about me? Am I a different person elsewhere than I am here? Because this bears upon you, and quite frankly, this is a big deal. This point here is a big deal. What we're seeing in Timothy and Titus is not a list of qualifications, but rather a list, if you want, of characteristics. It's painting the picture of a man of God, not just filling a position here. Young men can't fulfill that picture. A 35-year-old might be bright and talented and so on, but he's not sufficiently experienced. He is not of a polished character that has been proven over time. He just can't be that kind of man. Does that mean that he's an inferior, deficient man? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It just means he can't be the elder that we need him to be. He's not the right man for the job yet. Hopefully he's working on it, though. Tonight we're going to focus much more on management skills and stewardship, especially with regard to the household, but this morning, as I said, we're just focusing largely, anyway, on character issues. Well, one of the responsibilities of preachers is to know about elders and deacons and then to teach this information, as I'm doing right now. Since Paul was talking to Timothy and Titus, who were preachers, ministers, and this is what he's telling them. And so that's one reason why we're doing this right now, anyway. And if we want this picture or this goal for ourselves, then we ought to examine the criteria. It shows what is important to God and how he evaluates people. Notice there's some things that are not important to God, up front anyway. What kind of job does this man have? What kind of car does he drive? What kind of house does he have, right? Is it a one-story or two-story, right? Does he have property or is it a rental? You know, what's his stand on the issues? How much money does he give? Is he a Democrat or a Republican? You notice that all those things aren't there. And it's not that they don't color the situation at all, but they're just not critical. What is emphasized is really what we can find summed up in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13 and 14. Be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong, let all you do be done in love. We need that kind of man. That's the man we need to be an elder. In general, that's the character we're looking for right there. Now, all the details, Paul, you know, explains and as we've looked at, but that's really what we want. We need a man who will be that before he's ever appointed. We need him to be that. But then, once again, what about you? Are you striving to be that kind of person? Does that define you? Because that's really what it comes down to as well. All right? We'll go into part two tonight. I hope that you can be here for that. And we'll discuss more of the leadership aspect of that. I know this lesson, again, has not been an inspiring lesson in one sense, but it does inspire you, I hope, to strive to be the kind of godly man or godly woman that God wants you to be, okay? And I hope that you take that very seriously. I appreciate you being here, and if there's anyone that needs to come forward this morning for any spiritual need, by all means, do so now as we stand and sing the song that Richard has selected for